Welcome to the People and Projects Podcast, where you'll find interviews and insights to help you lead people and deliver projects. You can find us on the web at www.i-leadonline.com/podcast. This is Andy Kaufman, President of the Institute for Leadership Excellence and Development Incorporated. Thank you for joining us for this edition of the People and Projects Podcast. You know, I hear it all the time when people describe themselves in a work setting. One of the things they'll often say is, you know, I'm a pretty good problem solver. Let me ask you, are you a good problem solver? I guess you'd probably say, well, yeah. Well, guess what? According to Michael Roberto, author of Know What You Don't Know, maybe we're all focusing on the wrong thing. According to Michael, it's not about becoming better problem solvers. We need to be better problem finders. I had the opportunity to catch up with Michael by phone recently and look forward to sharing that interview with you today. I'm joined today by Michael Roberto, who's a preeminent authority on strategic decision-making, senior management teams, and neutralizing hidden threats to organizations. Michael is the trustee professor of management at Bryant University, served for 6 years on the faculty at Harvard Business School, and has been a visiting associate professor of management at New York University's Stern School of Business. His newest book, Know What You Don't Know, helps business leaders find and prevent problems before they happen, with practical techniques for recognizing hidden signs of trouble and for diffusing the potential threat. His previous book, Why Great Leaders Don't Take Yes for an Answer, was chosen by the Globe and Mail as one of the top 10 business books of 2005. Michael, thank you for joining us for the People and Projects Podcast.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here, Andy.
You know, there seems to be countless numbers of books out there about how to solve problems, like whole wings of libraries on problem solving. But your book, Know What You Don't Know, it's a whole different tack. Like, instead of being a great problem solver, you really direct us to be better problem finders. So what do you mean by that, Michael? And what led you to that conclusion?
The idea here is that many times when we're in organizations, we may be effective decision makers, we may be good at solving problems, but many of the key crucial problems that pose a great threat to our organization don't actually surface to us as leaders at whatever level we happen to be.
Right.
The problems remain hidden for a variety of reasons. First and foremost, people often are reluctant to share bad news with people in senior positions.
Yeah.
And therefore, we don't know the problems that need to be solved.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that because I've seen that same thing, Michael, where someone will say, well, neat idea about being a problem finder. But, you know, if I raise my hand, they're going to say, like, I'm being negative or not a team player, especially if I make the mistake of, you know, pulling the alarm on something that turns out to be at least perceived as a false alarm. Or, you know, one guy at a director level guy at a company told me once, he goes, you know, it seems like it's the problem solvers who get the kudos and the praise. You know, they're the ones who get their rewards. Almost like the faster we can pull them out of the river before they go over the waterfall, those are the better rewarded people than figuring out who's pushing them in the first place.
Yeah.
So how do people wrestle with those realities and still be a better problem finder?
Sure. Well, what I try to do in the book is say that the burden shouldn't really be on the person who's at the front lines, who's seeing the problem, because they face all of these obstacles and hurdles. They face the hierarchical pressures, the pressures to get the work done, the dangers of feeling like they might be perceived as Chicken Little.
Yeah.
They are the ones who, you know, they might be the messenger who gets shot. So instead of saying this is a book about helping those people surface problems, instead I put the burden on leaders to say, you have to understand that these natural obstacles exist, and people, for a variety of reasons, are going to be reluctant to come forward with bad news. So your job is to proactively go out and create an environment, invite them where they can come forward. So you need to go out and get the bad news and not wait for it to come to you. I often tell leaders, you know, you may have a policy, my door is always open, right?
Yeah.
And they always say yes. And I said, you know, that's grossly insufficient. That's like the professor who says, I have office hours. Please come to me if you're struggling in the course.
Yeah.
Well, of course, in order to come to office hours, I mean, you're admitting to struggling in the course. What student wants to do that? You know, I've sat in many office hours very lonely, and many executives face the same situation. So don't tell me your door is always open. Get out of your office. Go walk out the door and go look for what the problems are.
Mm. I had a chance to spend some time with a chief information officer recently, and he told me it was something related to this. And he said, you know, I have to force myself to question my assumptions. The idea is that he recognizes not only that there's maybe problems in the organization that don't get to him, but sometimes he's the problem, that he has his own biases and these conclusions that cause him to miss things. And my observation on this one, Michael, is it's easy for me to see this when other people are you know, suffering from confirmation bias, but how difficult when it's my own biases that are the problem. Now, I love the concept you have in your book about circumventing the gatekeepers, you know, those who filter the information. And part of the reason why we have trouble as leaders is the information doesn't get to us. But what about when I'm the one doing the filtering? You know, what do you personally do, Michael, in your job as a professor, but also when you're advising clients? What do you do to circumvent your own filtering?
It's a great, great question. And I have two pieces of advice on this. First of all, this is why one of your jobs as a leader is to build a great team, a team where people feel free to have candid dialogue. And really, the first book I wrote is all about that. It's about cultivating constructive debate and candid dialogue within your team.
Yeah.
How do you design a team and design a climate to do that? So that's one big.
Yeah.
The second thing, though, that you can do yourself, just sitting in your office, is I often find it very useful to make a list of those implicit assumptions you're making about the business model, about your customers, about your employees, make them explicit. As soon as you make them explicit, often you look at them and say, is that really true? It doesn't take a lot sometimes for, you know, you to begin to admit that they may not be truths, that they may indeed be assumptions, right?
Yeah.
But you need to write them down. You need to actually make a list sometimes.
Yeah, but you know what? I got to tell you, I think even in my own case, I mean, I've had some discussions with people about this, with the concept that if you want different results, instead of trying to do different things, try to look at it differently, right? I mean, that's kind of the concept. And so we'll talk about this. Like, what do you think are those fundamental aspects of your worldview about this situation or the way you look at this? And still, sometimes I feel like people give this confused dog look, you know, tilt the head and say, I don't know. It's hard to get to that. So your experience is at least force yourself to put it in a list, huh?
Force yourself, and then the next step, you know, use your team. I often say one of the best things you can do is appoint a devil's advocate.
Yeah.
Create someone who can be your sounding board, who you know, you trust, and they trust you, and they know you're not going to fire them if they challenge you. And help them help you by giving them the sort of license to push you, to challenge you, to contradict what you believe, and understand they're playing a role for you, right? So, and that can help. I don't think there's any one sort of panacea elixir for this, but I think a variety of these little techniques can be helpful and useful.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point. That kind of reinforces what you said about building a good team. The good team just doesn't mean competent, but good team also means that, you know, they can tell me when I have bad breath, so to speak. You know, they can challenge some assumptions, and they're willing to do that, huh?
No question. Yeah. No question. I think the other thing that I do talk about in the book a little bit is make sure you're listening to different voices. You know, make sure that you're not always listening to the same people, right? Because that can really create a one-track mind and a certain, you know, set of blinders. So make sure on any particular issue or any particular strategic challenge, make sure you're listening to different voices. You're seeking them out so that you are getting different perspectives. Because if you're always talking to the same few people who perhaps have been working the same issue with you for some time, and you all have a fairly similar worldview, then that can be a particular challenge.
Yeah, that's so true. I mentioned this in a recent interview. One night, I was watching Fox News, and then I had MSNBC on the other button, and I just went back and forth. And on the same issue, you know, healthcare reform, just looking at the two different worldviews that were presented. It was hilarious.
It's actually interesting you say that. Last night, I was doing something with a group of teens, and to make this point, I read to them, there's a story, I wish I could remember the name of the children's author. There's a children's author who rewrote the Little Red Riding Hood story from the perspective of the wolf.
Okay.
and basically, it's the same set of facts, but basically the wolf explains why he's really a good-hearted fellow who only ate them, you know, out of desperation and to protect himself. And, you know, it's just a funny way of making the same point, right?
Oh, it is. But, you know, if you only talk to the wolves or you surround yourself with, you know, Little Red Riding Hood, you know, as a leader, which just happens all the time, right? You hire in your own image sometimes. And so I think that's good advice. By far, I wish I would have learned that lesson earlier, Michael, about who I surround myself will significantly impact me more than I realize. To this day, some of my best friends are people who are quite different from me, almost along the lines of those same reasons, just to make sure I don't get in a rut.
Yeah, I guess I'm a little bit blessed in this regard, because if you're in the academy, if you're a professor, you almost by definition end up surrounded by a lot of people who kind of think differently than you.
Yeah.
They're just by nature, right?
Yeah.
Part of the deal.
Well, you know, one of the stories I got a kick out of when I went through your book was you tell a story of Kimberly Clark. I was there recently facilitating a project management workshop. Some people in the class actually brought up this story you brought up in the book about there was some observation going on. Let's watch parents change diapers. You know, what a concept. We're actually going to watch. And they just realized that, well, how do I hold my baby while I reach for all this other stuff? And you tell them this story in your book about how it led to a redesign in the travel pack, and that this is an example of being an ethnographer. So, you know, what do you mean by that? That's not a word I hear people say very often. So what do you mean by that? And what are some practical ways that someone listening to this could try to practice that?
Sure. So ethnographer is a sort of very academic term. It is derived from the field of anthropology. And sort of think of Margaret Mead, you know, writing her famous book, Coming of Age in Samoa. Mm-hmm. She was practicing ethnography. That is to say, she wasn't simply conducting interviews or surveys. She was actually going out and living in that natural setting and observing in that natural setting how people were behaving and coming to her conclusions. And as it turns out, particularly in the field of marketing, but also in other areas, there is a great emphasis now on this. Companies have become somewhat disenchanted, for example, with focus groups, because, shocker, people often say one thing and do another.
Right.
What you hear in focus groups doesn't often turn out to be the way people actually behave. And so Kimberly Clark and Procter & Gamble and Microsoft and some of the other major consumer products firms have gone out there and actually hired either professional anthropologists or trained marketing people to go out and observe. And so, for example, Procter & Gamble sends people to do home visits where they ask for permission to go into consumers' home, and they want to observe them doing mundane tasks like washing their laundry, of course, using P&G products.
Of course.
Or perhaps Rivals products, perhaps.
Yeah.
And watching and trying to understand from that behavior. Or they also do shopping visits. In that case, they actually go out and shop with consumers or work the store where consumers shop so they can watch how people not only use products but select the products.
Mm.
And great insight comes from being able to watch without biasing that behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And when we ask questions, whether we know it or not, we often in a survey or a focus group ask leading questions.
Sure.
And that can be problematic. And I apply this to the notion of problem finding beyond even your customers. I think you can observe within your organizations as well, and you can observe supplier behavior and employees and the like, and beginning to practice that as a leader can be very useful. And you know, I tell an anecdote about when Dave Neilman ran JetBlue.
Mm-hmm.
He used to don an apron that said Snack Boy and wander the aisles of his planes when he was on a flight serving snack customers. And, of course, what he's doing there, not only is he directly listening to customers who quickly, you know, find out that he's the CEO, but also he's observing what's going on in his plane, not just his customers, he's observing his crew.
Yeah.
And he's learning a great deal about what the problems are and how he can improve service on the airline.
One of the funny focus group stories I recall was the taste challenge between Coke and Pepsi. And my grandfather, so he's in his late 80s at this point, he goes up to it and they say, all right, take a drink of this one and take a drink of this one. Which one do you like better? He says, the Pepsi one. And they go, no, the one on the left or the one on the right? Pick it. He goes, the Pepsi one.
Yep.
It's classic, right? Sometimes those maybe just don't work out the way that we want.
No, and from what I understand from talking to some Coke folks, I didn't put this in the book. This was a conversation that happened after I wrote the book. Back when Coke introduced New Coke, I understand that some of the way they asked the questions in some of the focus groups led to them down the wrong path to believing that people wouldn't miss the old formula.
Yeah.
And that they actually concluded that it was their questions and the way they framed them that were the problem.
Yeah, and I buy that 100%. But, you know, let's say someone goes, well, Michael, I manage by walking around. Like that's leadership 101, manage by walking around. I do that, but I'm not seeing things. Is there more than just managing by walking around, would you say, for the average leader who has a bunch of people out in his cubicles here?
Absolutely. So I really go through and try to offer some very concrete, detailed advice as to how to engage in systematic observation, how to decide who you're going to observe and how. How do you triangulate? In other words, how do you seek other data to confirm your observation so you're not drawing anecdotal sort of one-off conclusions, right, perhaps erroneously.
Right.
I talk about how you record what you're observing. And, you know, I refer to what David Garvin mentioned in his book on learning organizations, where he cites what Charles Darwin did when he was working on his theory of evolution. Darwin recorded observations regarding his theory, but he kept a separate notebook where he recorded observations that contradicted his emerging theory. Helping to really sort out in his mind, you know, the data and the evidence. And so I think there are a number of do's and don'ts that I try to outline that go beyond the simple management by walking around.
Yeah. That'll be great advice for people who pick up the book. You know, every once in a while I'll get an email, often from my father, who sends every urban legend to me. And, you know, but every once in a while I'll get this picture, stare at this picture. And if you stare long enough, all of a sudden something jumps out at you. Right? And, you know, sometimes I get it right away. And other times I'm sure this is some sort of practical joke, but I thought of that when I read in your book about the hunting for patterns and connecting the dots. As I totally buy that they're vital behaviors, and yet it just seems like some people are better at seeing these patterns or connecting the dots than others. So, you know, any advice you could share on how could anybody improve their ability to hunt for patterns, let's say?
That's a great question. And I think there's two things that you know that we can do that will be really helpful. Number one, you've got to really do your best to try to break down silos and barriers and facilitate horizontal integration and sharing of information in the organization. Because if that's going on, it's going to be easier to see patterns and connect dots.
Mm-hmm.
One of the biggest barriers to connecting the dots is the fact that there are barriers to communication. So the information is sitting in fragmented pieces throughout the organization. And so that makes it very difficult for any one person who's in a leadership position to connect the dots.
Sure.
And, you know, we write about the 9/11 tragedy and others like that and talking about that. I think the other thing you can do, though, is think carefully. What I talk about in the book is that the way that we see patterns, the way that experts become so good at seeing patterns, is they become particularly adept at reasoning by analogy. And all that means is that when we're making decisions, when we're looking at problems, we all do this subconsciously, sometimes more consciously at other occasions.
Yeah.
We are looking and saying, this is like a situation we've seen in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is some people are much better than that at others. What those of us who stumble on that do is we focus too much on the similarities, and we are not quick enough to note differences between what we're seeing today at this moment and something we've seen in the past.
Yeah.
And so the people who are better at that take close attention to differences, not just similarities.
That's great advice. You and I are both in the advice sharing business in some ways as we try to develop people. And I always have to go back and question, what is it that I'm teaching that I struggle with myself? So when you think of all that you talk about, whether it would be in know what you don't know, or perhaps even in the why great leaders don't take yes for an answer, what's the most difficult for you to follow yourself, Michael?
It's a great question. You know, it's a great, because I'll say, there's two things. I think number one, I just mentioned the analogies thing.
Yeah.
I make that same mistake.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't tell you how many times I realize after the fact, wow, I ignored a crucial difference between this situation and what I've experienced in the past.
Yeah.
I mean, it's easy to do that, but it's still something I find myself, you know, aware of, and I kick myself, you know, when I fail to do that. So the other thing, I think, I hope that I've gotten pretty good at trying to make sure others who work around me understand that I welcome dissenting views. But I think that the harder part sometimes is when you are trying to make an argument to people above you, and you're trying to do that in a way that doesn't make them defensive. And I got to say, I have work to do there. Sometimes it's very easy for me to get frustrated when I think senior leadership just doesn't get it, you know, and you make this argument and you make it in a way that immediately puts them on the defensive, and now you've lost your ability to really engage in persuasion and influence. And so, you know, I talk about speaking up effectively. It's not just speaking up, it's how do you do it effectively? And I think all of us have work to do in that regard, you know.
And
the more we care about an issue in a perverse kind of way, the harder it is sometimes to speak up effectively, because we get, you know, we get emotional, we get, you know, we're so engaged in the issue, and sometimes we just, you know, we blurt out our ideas or our arguments without thinking about what's really the best way that we can go about exercising influence here.
You know, I think you just came up with the next book right there, Michael. I'll buy it, okay?
So yeah, if I could solve that riddle, boy, oh my goodness.
I think you're right. I think it's a key issue. You know, I just appreciate you taking time today. You know, not only is it a timely book, I think this concept of being a problem finder really transcends even the difficult times we're going through, economy with businesses right now. It's one of those things that there will always be these problems out there, and getting on the front end of it just makes so much sense. For For those who are listening, I really highly recommend you get your hands, actually on both of Michael's books, Know What You Don't Know, and Great Leaders Don't Take Yes for an Answer. We just like barely touched on the important insights that Michael offers in these books. So if you find yourself intrigued, add these books to your reading list and start learning. I put the names and links to these books in the show notes of the cast, and I also recommend you check out Michael's blog. You can see a link to that in the show notes for the cast as well. Michael, thank you for joining us today on the People and Projects podcast. I really enjoyed the opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you, Andy, for offering such interesting questions and for a great dialogue.
One way that project managers become better problem finders is through risk management. Have you ever been trained on how to more effectively manage risks? I've got an e-learning module entitled What You Need to Know About Risk Management. You can learn how to use risk management to become a better problem finder. And, well, why not earn 2 PDUs while you're at it? And as a thanks for listening to the People and Projects podcast, you can save $20 off the $49.95 list price. Just use a coupon code of podcast1009 when you order. Check the show notes for details on how to start learning. Hey, before we wrap up, may I ask you a favor? I invite you to tell a friend or colleague about the People and Projects podcast. I continue to be amazed at how many people still haven't started using podcasts as part of their professional development strategy. Send them a link or tell them how to find us on iTunes. Thank you very much for that. And thank you for joining us for today's episode. Have yourself a great week. We'll see you next time on the People and Projects podcast.